Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Many thanks to the Dutch consulate, the Dutch Embassy in Canberra for making this possible. I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. The Minister will speak for about half an hour. We'll take some questions and discussion, finish around 1:45 or 1:50. So that's how it'll run. Now, the Minister, Maxime Verhagen, has worked, has a long CV, and I'll be very brief as usual, has worked with the Christian Democratic Alliance in the Netherlands, but has been a member of the was a member of the European Parliament from 1989 to 1994, and a member of the House of Representatives, becoming then a member of the House of Representatives, becoming leader of the CDA Parliamentary Party in 2002. But of course, since February 2007, the Minister has been Minister for Foreign Affairs in the fourth Balkan Ender government, which of course is a coalition government led by the Christian Democrats. And today we're very honoured to have the Minister here on an important visit to Australia, and as you know, the relationship between Australia and the Netherlands is a very significant one, and for us he's going to speak for us, to us today on Australia, the Netherlands and the world joining forces to make the world a better, safer place. Minister, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Henderson. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's a great pleasure to be here at the Sydney Institute, and I would like to thank you all for coming. And a special word of thanks, of course, also to Gerald Henderson, the Executive Director of the Sydney Institute, for hosting today's event and for all his help in the preparations. I realise that you should all be out enjoying your summer holidays, or at least your lunch, so I'm all the more pleased to have the opportunity to speak to you here today, and that you have come in such a great amount. In the Netherlands, you hardly can imagine, over New Year, many Dutch people got their ice skates out. With weeks of sub-zero temperatures, we were delighted for the first time in over a decade to get reacquainted with our national pastime of skating on the country's network of lakes and canals. And meanwhile, down under, here you are celebrating summer, surfing instead of skating, suntanned instead of frostbitten. It's clear that our countries are 10,000s of miles apart. And yet, despite the distance between us, Australia and the Netherlands have a great deal in common. Our shared history dates back over 400 years. Dutch seafarers first landed on Australian soil in 1606. Abel Tasman charted large sections of the coast in 1644, and his maps later helped Captain Cook reach Sydney Harbour. And 3 centuries later, after the Second World War, many Dutch immigrants made their way to Australia. Prospects in war-ridden Europe were poor, while Australia was a land of opportunity. Today it's estimated that some 400,000 Australians have Dutch blood running through their veins. Maybe that explains also the popularity of Dutch musician André Rieu, who happens to be from my hometown. And our people also share a love of sport. We often compete against each other in swimming and field hockey. In fact, I saw the Australian and the Dutch national hockey teams practicing together in Perth, and they'll play each other four times, and I hope, of course, that we can get our revenge after losing the bronze medal to you at the Olympics. Our joint celebration of 400 years of bilateral relations in 2006 greatly contributed to strengthening the bond between us. The distance between Sydney and Canberra is just about the same, equals that of my country, north to south. So you can imagine how small my country is. But nonetheless, our two countries' population size and GDP are close. According to the IMF, Australia has the 15th largest economy in the world, while that of the Netherlands is ranked 16th. We both have open economies and are strong supporters of free trade. And our people have benefited greatly from this open international orientation. But we also share the same values. Our countries cherish freedom, democracy, respect for human rights. But we are both going through a process of redefining the role of our armed forces. We understand each other, and we work well together. Let me mention just a few examples. Australian and Dutch troops were in Al-Mutanna provinces in Iraq. And in Afghanistan, our troops have been working shoulder to shoulder in difficult circumstances to improve the security situation and to offer a brighter future to the Afghan people. Within the United Nations, both countries strongly advocate the principle of the responsibility to protect, urging states to take responsibility for the protection of their own civilians. And both our countries have contributed to the Global Center for Responsibility to Protect, which is located in New York and co-chaired by former Australian Foreign Minister Gareth Evans. The Netherlands strongly supports Australia's bid for a seat at the Security Council in 2013. And we also welcome another Australian-led initiative, the International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament. And I feel that the international mood is swinging back to the idea of a nuclear-free world. So I truly hope that this commission can help move us towards that goal and make the 2010 review conference on NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty, a success. Australia and Japan have our full support in leading this effort, and the Netherlands stands ready to assist in any way possible. And I'm happy that Dutch former Foreign Minister Hans van den Broek, one of my predecessors, will be on the Commission's advisory board. So while we may be a long way apart geographically, I would say that our interests and priorities are closely aligned. Our way of thinking and our operating methods are surprisingly similar. And I've traveled to Australia to underline this importance and the importance the Netherlands attaches to its friendship with Australia and to see how we can further strengthen our partnership. I believe that in this day and age, one should invest in friends. The world is in a state of flux. Geopolitical realities are shifting at a time when nations need to come together to address a number of great challenges. Climate change, poverty and exclusion, terrorism, and of course the global financial crisis, to name but a few. And in such uncertain times, it's good to know who you can count on. And that's why I've come to Australia. And one of the main reasons why I had extensive discussions with my dear colleague Stephen Smith in Perth yesterday. Given the problems we face, a joint course of action is essential. The painful universal effects of the global financial crisis have clearly brought this home to us. We cannot meet today's challenges in isolation. If solutions are to be effective, we need to be able to rely on each other. And this afternoon I would like to discuss ways in which we, Australia and the Netherlands, can join forces to make the world a better safer place. Traditionally, the Netherlands has always invested heavily in multilateral frameworks. Like Australia, we are a founding state of the United Nations. The lessons of the Second World War convinced us that we needed a strong international order to make the world a safer and more equitable place for our own protection as much as anything else. The UN system and the Bretton Woods institutions are based on legal principles that apply to all people and all nations. They are designed to impose order and to prevent or resolve conflict. And it's to our advantage that all actors, especially the leading players, commit themselves to that system and its rules. A world in which everyone acts as a responsible stakeholder and works within the international framework will be a better place for all. And accordingly, Dutch foreign policy aims to bind as many countries as possible to this international structure. We focus on using the international framework to influence the actions of other countries, and it's a strategy of co-option of effecting change through cooperation. However, these days, the international system is under pressure, tremendous pressure. It has lost its appeal in many countries because it's perceived as being insufficiently representative. New economic powers are demanding a greater role on the global stage, and that's inevitable and entirely understandable. These countries, some of which are Australia's close neighbours, must be accommodated. Take, for example, the requirement that the presidents of the World Bank and the IMF still have to be an American and a European, respectively. That's untenable, and it excludes the 3.5 billion representatives of the world's fastest-growing economies. The global order, while retaining its principles, must be reshaped to incorporate and constructively engage a host of rising powers. That's a challenge we cannot shy away from. But equally, it must be clear that better representation comes at a price. It must be accompanied by taking on greater responsibility. I expect that the emerging economies will do so, but as this is not yet the case, we must continuously encourage them. Therefore, while the need for a responsive international system may be greater than ever before, the prospect of seeing such concerted action in the near future is less promising. And that's all the more true given the fact that many countries have called into question the legitimacy of universal values like justice, human treatment, solidarity, and liberty. Some governments apparently do not agree that human rights apply to all people, in all places, and at all times. Even though all 192 members of the United Nations have adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights 6 years ago. And there is now an increasingly large and increasingly vocal counter-movement which maintains that human rights are a Western invention. The influential Singaporean opinion leader Kishore Mahbubani, for example, has dismissed the emphasis on human rights as ideological triumphalism. I couldn't disagree more. I don't see anything triumphalist about promoting human rights worldwide. It's nothing less than a moral duty to people whose governments prevent them from living their lives in dignity. And that's why I have placed human rights at the very center of the Dutch foreign policy. Again, we find common ground here with the Australian government. Ladies and gentlemen, many Dutch people, as well as Australians, might be skeptical of what can be achieved by international organizations. They say it's all talk, but no action. But I would like to underline, there is no alternative. When states renounce the system and try to withdraw from agreements they have made, the world becomes a less safe and less stable place. Stability depends on order and rule. And because instability is not in our interest, we must continuously adapt the international system to our present-day requirements. There is only one world community. And with the advent of globalization and the growing tensions between countries, regions and religions, between North and South, rich and poor, multilateralism is now more relevant than ever. The Netherlands thus remains committed to strengthening the international multilateral system. And although it may require difficult, demanding efforts, I hope our partners will be there at our side, including, of course, Australia. A multilateral commitment is often the only way to bring lasting peace to conflict-ridden areas. We've seen this in Timor-Leste and elsewhere in the Pacific, where Australia has showed impressive leadership, and I'm convinced that the same holds true for Gaza in the Middle East. There can be no way forward without an agreement which has serious international backing, both in terms of security and development. And for that reason, my Danish colleague and I, myself, put forward two initiatives over the past 2 weeks to stop weapons getting into Gaza. So now, more than ever, we need to forge strong alliances with countries that share our values. And of course, for the Netherlands, a strong European Union is key. Our most effective way to exert influence in the world is through Europe. That's a simple reality. Australia, too, places great emphasis on regional cooperation. At least that's what I infer from Prime Minister Rudd's proposal for an Asia-Pacific community based on the European Union model. I believe, truly believe, that regional cooperation is the way forward. 50 years of European integration have brought us unprecedented stability and prosperity. Later today, the new President of the United States will be inaugurated, and it's a momentous occasion for various reasons. Europe's relationship with the United States is extremely important, as is Australia's. And although we are clearly seeing shifts in global power, the United States' role in the world's most pressing issues, such as responding to climate change, preserving peace and stability in many parts of the world, their leadership is still needed. And that's why the transatlantic relationship, whether through NATO or the European Union, remains the cornerstone of Dutch foreign policy, as it does for Australian foreign policy. The Netherlands and the European Union also need to look beyond their traditional alliances. We need to strengthen the team, so to speak. And Australia is definitely a top player that we would love to have on board. I believe that intensifying our cooperation would be highly worthwhile. As I've said, we may not be close in geographical terms, but we are definitely close in spirit. And the European Union-Australia partnership framework that was concluded last autumn provides useful starting points for future cooperation. Preferably, that partnership should be as practical and result-oriented as possible. Climate change is a logical issue for us to collaborate on, but there are many others, including high-level cooperation on immigration and counter-terrorism. Australia is already NATO's largest partner outside of the alliance. Ladies and gentlemen, I've spoken about the United Nations, I've discussed cooperation between Australia and the European Union, and I would like to close by saying a few words about NATO and our partnership in Afghanistan. And I'd like to stress at the outset how important it is that Australia and other non-NATO members that contribute to ISAF are included in discussions of our joint mission in Afghanistan. The Netherlands will continue to advocate Australia's inclusion. Working together in Afghanistan has clearly created a strong bond between our countries and our people. We've worked hard. We've had our setbacks, but, and this is the rewarding part, we've also shared our success. Look at Talinkout, the capital of Uruzgan, Afghanistan today. Town's lights are on. The bazaar is busier than ever. More children go to school, and the hospital has been expanded. On a bright morning, the town has the feel of an ordinary provincial capital, bustling with activity as people go about their daily business. And in most other provinces, too, there are indications of progress. And this is definitely something to be proud of. At the same time, we all understand that the situation remains fragile, and we still have a very long way to go before sustainable security can be established, before development takes root, and before full Afghan ownership, which is our ultimate objective, becomes a reality. 2009 will be a crucial year for Afghanistan. The upcoming presidential elections will be an important test for the Afghan government. Fair and credible elections will reaffirm the legitimacy of the Afghan government. And we must help the Afghan government to enable as many people as possible to cast their vote. Nowhere is this more important than in the south of the country, where segments of the population are disaffected and do not feel represented by the government in Kabul. And these people need to see that they can have a say in how their country is governed, an opportunity the Taliban could try to deny them. Another important event this year is the arrival, of course, of the additional US troops in the east and south of Afghanistan. And these troops will allow ISAF to expand its operation and increase its level of ambition. But if we are to win this conflict, we need a broad, comprehensive approach. In 2009, we need to increase our efforts to bring reconstruction and better governance to the people of Afghanistan, particularly in the south. We are making tangible progress, but the pace has been slow, and too many Afghans have seen only limited benefits from the democratically elected government in Kabul. And this is one of the main reasons why the Taliban has been able to stage a comeback. And this means we will need to provide the government with more funds and more expertise to help to build Afghan capacity. That also means that we will need to push the Afghan government to perform better. And the most effective weapon against the Taliban is not a helicopter or a missile, but a competent, effective government official with personal integrity who is willing to work for the benefit of the wider Afghan population rather than his own tribal group. And such officials are still too thin on the ground. Finally, we have to come to terms with the fact that Afghanistan is part of a volatile region and that its problems cannot be solved in isolation. We are, of course, concerned about developments in tribal areas of Pakistan. The terrorist attacks in Mumbai and the resulting tensions between India and Pakistan have shown how events elsewhere can have knock-on effects for Afghanistan. And as partners in ISAF, we must work together closely and coordinate our efforts. There are no easy solutions, no silver bullets to deal with these issues. What we do have to do is together, the Netherlands and Australia, in our cooperation in ISAF. As you know, the Netherlands will conclude its present role as lead nation in Uruzgan by the end of 2010, 2 or more years to go. But by that time, we will have led the ISAF task force for 4 years, having previously led a provincial reconstruction team in Baghlan province for 2 years. And as Australia knows better than most, the mission in the south of Afghanistan is tough, and by the end of 2010, we will be up against the limits of what our armed forces can sustain. the time has come for one of our allies to step in and shoulder part of the burden in the south. This does not mean that the Netherlands will abandon Afghanistan or ISAF. Our commitment to helping the government with reconstruction, development and improving governance is open-ended. But how the Netherlands will contribute military to ISAF mission beyond 2010 is a subject that will be examined in due course. It's clear that the international community needs more resources to successfully complete the difficult mission it has taken on in Afghanistan. And in that respect, I have repeatedly called for an increased investment in our defence capability, both at national and at European level. Not only must the European Union countries invest in cooperation among the various European armed forces, but we must also spend more money in our national defence capabilities. We cannot allow the United States to account for the better part of global military capabilities while its European allies fail to pay their full share. And since NATO is as important today as it was when it was founded 60 years ago, I hope that we can demonstrate progress in this area in the coming years. It's badly needed. In any case, NATO's 60th birthday anniversary this year will be a good opportunity to reaffirm the values on which the North Atlantic Treaty was founded. Demonstrating NATO's continued commitment to democracy, freedom and human rights is enormously important, symbolically, especially in a world where these values are under threat. And this is the source of NATO's moral authority. And in reaffirming that commitment, we send a clear signal to other countries that cherish these values, like Australia, that NATO is eager to work with them. I believe the multinational force in Afghanistan, to which both our countries contribute, stands out as a model for future military cooperation. In this day and age, our armed forces operate in a truly international environment. We are working hand in hand with many different parties and partners, not least with the Afghans themselves. And doing so has taught us many valuable lessons. Our comprehensive approach, integrating defence, development and diplomacy, has proven its value. And I expect this approach to continue to guide us in all our peace operations. And I will strongly urge all stakeholders, including the new US administration, with its incoming additional troops, to continue this integrated, comprehensive approach. Ladies and gentlemen, a champion team will always beat a team of champions. And one of Australia's oldest football clubs, the Collingwood Magpies, has built their club around this principle. And it's true that if we put our collective interests first and work together, we will perform better and achieve more. And I hope that Australia and the Netherlands can both be part of that champion team, which will be a decisive force for good in the world. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Minister. So we come to questions and discussion. Just stand there and won't be long. Before we do, I just say thanks to Cause Chambers Westgarth for the use of this fine facility today. And so we come to questions and discussion. We'll go for about 15 minutes or thereabouts. And I think you're going to hand that to... There we are. There are a couple of seats down around the front if anyone wants from the back wants to come up. You've had some important meetings in Australia, and you've got some more tomorrow, and it's pretty clear what you're going to say about Afghanistan. Can I just ask you a bit about your role as a foreign minister? And you spoke today about the initiative between Denmark and the Netherlands about stopping arms coming from Egypt into Gaza. And of course, as you know, the French president has been active in this area. But to what extent now is there a Dutch foreign policy or a Danish foreign policy or a French foreign policy or is there a European Union foreign policy, and what are you going to tell senior ministers in Australia about to what extent, if there is a difference between a Dutch position and a European position?
Well, of course, there is no difference between the Dutch position and a European position. Of course, as we are part of the European Union, we contribute to the European position. And to make it more clear, when the conflict in the Middle East, in Gaza, started, we immediately had a meeting in Paris, the 30th of December, to discuss amongst the Minister for Foreign Affairs the way how we could contribute to reach the ceasefire. Of course, the conflict as such is terrible, and we deplore the casualties, especially also the normal, ordinary people, so the non-combatants who were killed or wounded. At the same time, it's clear that no Israeli government could afford, can afford, not to respond to a daily attack of several rockets. In the month of December, more than 300 rockets were fired at the southern part of Israel. So they rolled to other cities and were under daily attacks. And I think that no government can afford doing nothing against terrorism, doing nothing on daily rocket attacks. Same time, it was clear that in immediate or as soon as possible to reach a ceasefire. So the Netherlands worked hard to support the European Union presidency to reach the ceasefire. And that's the reason why there was also a combined mission of the European Union presidency, the High Representative of the European Union, and the incoming presidency of Sweden, which will be the successor of the Czechs, together with the French president as the chair of the Security Council, but it was rather well coordinated to reach the ceasefire. So we welcome the ceasefire as it was reached, and hope, of course, that Hamas as well as Israel will not resort to further violence. And in that respect, in the discussions, and also in the discussions with my American colleague, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, President Abbas, and the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Israel, Tzipi Livni, we realized that to reach a sustainable ceasefire, it was necessary not only to call upon both sides to stop the violence, but to prevent it. In the same time, this ceasefire was used for arms smuggling, rearmament of Hamas, because otherwise we would have had within 2 years, or we will have within 2 years or within 1 year, again the same problems as we are faced today. And that's the reason why my Danish colleague and myself offered to take up a role in a monitoring force to monitor the borders between Gaza and Egypt, so that this border would be open for goods, people, humanitarian assistance, but to prevent arms smuggling and the traffic of ammunition towards Gaza. And that's the reason why we want to offer assistance to control the borders. Because it's absolutely necessary at this stage that we take further steps in order to fully implement UN Resolution 1860, break the vicious circle of violence. And it is clear in this respect that the Palestinian population must have unhindered access to humanitarian aid and food, but at the same time we need to have a better monitoring of the Egyptian Gaza border in order to prevent the smuggling of weapons and rockets. And like Australia, as I discussed also yesterday with my colleague Stephen Smith, for the solution, not of this conflict, but of the solution of the Middle East problem as such, it's obvious that we share the view that the peace process that started in Annapolis with the involvement of several Arabic countries, the involvement of the Palestinian Authority, the involvement of Israel, the involvement of the European Union and Russia, should be continued, with the result, as a result, of to create a viable Palestinian state and an Israel that is secure within its borders. And as the negotiations between the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority were rather successful until the violence broke again out, we must do our utmost, also together with the new American administration, to make sure that this peace process, which started in Annapolis, will be continued and will be successful in the forthcoming year. Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, as the Dutch Antilles are part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands, we are actually neighbors. So therefore, it's also in our interest to have good relations with Venezuela. At the same time, it's obvious that we also want for the future a good neighbor to this part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands, and of course tensions which might influence the position of the Dutch citizens in the Dutch Antilles will of course be responded by our side. We have to deal with Venezuela. We try to contact them. Of course, we have through our diplomatic channels also often contact when certain rumors about claims in the region are made, to make clear that also the territorial integrity of the kingdom will be ensured. But I must underline that according to these contacts, the direct contacts and the explanations we have asked also for certain claims which were rumored, for example, in the press, that there was no convincing argument that it was more than a rumor. Of course, we look to developments in the region. We have a, in relation to Colombia, we have a strong also cooperation together with Colombia to fight drug trafficking, to fight organized crime. And we support also the Colombian authorities in their policy to end the drug production and what's linked with that. So we have quite good contacts also with Colombia. In general, the Dutch Antilles play a role in relation to also the fighting of drug transporting and drug-related crimes. For example, we have the forward operating locations, the four located in the Dutch Antilles, which are also used to get information about possible drug trafficking. We have a large border control through our ships and vessels.
We don't have a lot of time to jump back. Yeah. The Dutch citizen, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, has visited Australia several times and spoken. The attitude of the Dutch government to her seems to be somewhat ambiguous, particularly the very public withdrawing of security protection. Is there any truth in her contention that Holland, I think it's her contention, certainly others, that Holland is gradually moving towards being a majority Muslim country? And has this effect? Is this related to the outbreaks of anti-Semitism in Holland, particularly one Dutch member of parliament?
First, I would like to underline that we indeed are a country where several religions and several different religions live together. But I would like also to underline that as we stand for the respect for human rights, it's obvious that one of these human rights is also the right to believe, the right to practice your belief, the freedom of religion. That applies not only to Christians, as the majority of the Dutch people are, it applies also to Muslims. So I don't like people who say that they are for the respect of human rights, but limited to their own people, or limited it to, for example, only the Christians. When I criticize certain governments, when they make it difficult for Christians to practice their belief in their country, then I, of course, have to ensure that it's also possible for Muslims in the Netherlands to practice their belief. That is the first remark. Second remark is that it's completely exaggerated that a majority of the Netherlands would be is Muslim. There are, of course, migrants. There are second generation people who are Muslim. That's indeed true. I don't know the exact numbers, but it's exaggerated if we sketch an image as if the Netherlands is a Muslim country. Then, in relation to the remarks of Hirsi Ali in relation to our protection, she was member of parliament, and at that time she was, due to her political statements, strongly under attack by email, by threats, etc., etc. And that was one of the reasons that she got protection. She had bodyguards, everything. After a certain period, she herself decided to migrate to the United States of America. And as we are, as government, responsible for her security when she is in the Netherlands, according to our view, the United States of America is responsible for the protection and security when she is in the United States. Nevertheless, we were so generous to pay for more than 2 years the protection and the bodyguards when she was in the United States. But then we said, as it is the obligation of each country to take care for the security of people who are on their soil, according to our view, the United States should take the responsibility, and you can't have a situation where we have to pay indefinitely. But when she's in the Netherlands, she will get the protection, she will get the bodyguards, she will get the protected car, everything which is needed to her to move freely in the Netherlands.
Thanks. Now we've just got, unfortunately, we've only got time for two quick questions. One here, and then Ralph will finish with Nancy again. Yeah.
You spoke about a return to strong moves towards negotiating a nuclear-free world coming back into focus. How will that happen with states like North Korea and Iran, the very own reason determined to develop nuclear capacity? I mean, how will we get there?
Yeah, well, in regard to those countries, of course, as they are obliged to fulfill their obligation through the on the basis of the several treaties which they have signed themselves, or which they are obliged to in relation to UN resolutions, we have to ensure that those UN resolutions or the cooperation with the IAEA is guaranteed. In that respect, towards Iran, I am strongly in favor of a two-way approach. The first one is keep talking, keep trying to convince them and offer them also the perspective of normal relations when they cooperate, when they fulfill the obligations on the basis of the UN resolutions, the Security Council resolutions. Second one is when they don't cooperate, sanctions. And I strongly favor more sanctions towards Iran if they stay non-cooperative as they are nowadays. If we look to the latest reports of El Baradei towards the developments in Iran, it's obvious that his remarks are more negative than they were a few months ago. Still not cooperating, not answering the questions they have to answer, and in that respect also remarks in relation to their missile program. So not only the nuclear program, but also the missile program, which is quite endangering. And therefore, according to my view, a new sanction regime or additional sanctions are needed to ensure that this two-way approach, talking and sanctions on the other side, can be effective. And we offer them also through the European Union a package. It was in cooperation with the permanent members of the Security Council, a package of positive measures which they could get if they were more cooperative. So when they fulfill their obligations, they will be awarded. When they stay stubborn, according to my view, they should get more sanctions.
Final quick question, Lynn Ralph. Yeah.
So you said that human rights is kind of key to foreign policy, which I applaud you for, because often it seems many countries place international trade as the centerpiece of their foreign policy. Obviously, trade and human rights are often interconnected, and I wonder if you could just talk briefly about the approach the Netherlands takes in balancing those two issues.
Well, according to my view, those two elements are not opposed to each other. According to my view, it's also in the interest of companies to have a stable world, to have a region where they can invest or export their goods. They can export more goods, they can invest more when the other country is also stable, when human rights are respected. That's for one. So it's also in the interests, according to my view, of these companies. They can have more exports, more trade, when human rights are respected, when the situation in these countries are stable. At the same time, through the contacts you have with certain countries, on the basis of trade relations, it's also easier to have access to these countries and have access to their government to have a human rights dialogue. It's easier for me to speak with Russia on, for example, the respect for human rights, or with China on the respect for human rights, when I have also a broader range of relations, for example, trade relations. It's not a question of when I don't have trade relations, then there will be an improvement of human rights. When I have, for example, no contract on gas with Russia, the human rights situation will not improve. There will be no improvement of the situation for a human rights defender who in China, when I don't have any trade relations. But through relations I have with China, amongst others, while I have trade relations, I have access to the government and I can discuss with them the need to protect also human rights, to improve the situation. And it's also in the interest of these countries to have a stable climate. So therefore, on the basis of the good relations I have through these trade relations, I can also closely work together with them, for example, on the judicial system, to improve the judicial system. The collaborators from our Ministry of Justice are working together with the Chinese authorities to improve their judicial system, especially also in relation to the death penalty. Because we oppose the death penalty and we want to have it also more transparent and have a situation of moratorium. But we work together, and the reason that we can work together also through our judicial cooperation is while we have also normal trade relations. When we wouldn't have had trade relations, the Chinese would never have allowed our judicial collaborators to enter their country to work together with their government to improve this law. So, according to my view, those two elements are not opposed to each other, but should contribute to each other.
Minister, many thanks. Please take a seat.
Yep.
there were many more questions, but we promised we'd finish at 10 to today, and that's what we're going to do, because the minister has other appointments, and it's a lunchtime function here as well. The minister's speech will be published, of course, in the Sydney papers, go up on our web, but from tomorrow it'll be up on our podcast. It was a very significant speech. We are important friends, the Netherlands and Australia, and you've covered the whole issue of the Netherlands and Australia and Afghanistan very thoroughly. And then we had a wide-ranging address on a whole number of issues, and then an all-encompassing question discussion period where we went from Latin America to Iran and back to human rights. And we're very grateful for you taking these questions and for your talk today. And it's an important address for us, and it'll live on in our publications and on our podcast. So for tonight, just to say many thanks and best wishes with your further discussions in Australia. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.